Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Those of us in both public health and healthcare have tightened our belts. It's going to be a tough beginning of the year.
Just as vaccines begin to roll out, variants of the coronavirus are spreading.
It's not more likely to make you seriously ill. That's a good thing. But think about it. The more contagious it is, the more people it will affect.
I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 30th, what this new coronavirus variant means for us. Also on the show, evictions have been on the rise due to the pandemic, and Black women are more likely to lose their homes than others.
We already know the renters that are most likely to be behind on their payment are Black women.
And from Hair Love to Soul, Black animation is breaking barriers, but they've still got a long way to go. We start with an update on COVID. The world is still very much in the grips of coronavirus, despite the introductions of vaccines across the globe. Last night, we learned that Louisiana Congressman-elect Luke Letlow had died from the virus. Letlow was 41 years old and left behind a wife and two children. He was due to be sworn into Congress on Sunday. Meanwhile, a new variant of the coronavirus has been spreading rapidly in parts of the world, including the UK, where it's driving a spike in cases that's stretching healthcare resources and pushing huge portions of England into lockdown. Now that variant, apparently more contagious than its predecessor, has been detected here in the US. Reports came yesterday afternoon that Colorado officials had identified one case in a man with no exposure through travel, meaning this variant is likely to be more widespread than we know. But scientists and other experts are urging calm, including Dr. Bill Schaffner, professor of infectious diseases and preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University. Bill, glad to have you back on the show to talk us through this.
My pleasure, Callie. Good to be with you.
And also with us to talk about what this variant tells us about the future of the virus is Apoorva Mondavilli, science reporter at the New York Times. Apoorva, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Bill, first things first, what exactly is a variant of a virus and how does it come about?
A variant is a virus that's mutated slightly, not very much, but somewhat. And the mutation makes it distinctive in some way so that it can be tracked. And in this instance, the variant virus has become, if you can imagine it, even more contagious. It's easier to spread. And that, of course, makes it very distinctive and very important from a public health point of view. And I would hasten to add right away, although it spreads even more readily, that spread can be inhibited by the standard things we've been urging everyone to do: wearing masks, social distancing, avoiding groups, staying at home. So we still have those important weapons against all of these strains of the COVID virus.
So just so we understand, what's the difference between variant, strain, and mutation?
Well, the mutation is what happens in the genes of the virus. Those genes change enough, and then we say it's a variant. For example, I'm Bill Schaffner, but I can put on different sport coats. And if my genes change enough so that I'm always wearing the gray sport coat instead of the brown one, then that's the brown sport coat variant of Bill.
Okay. How many strains are there of COVID-19, and why is this one getting so much attention?
Well, viruses mutate all the time, and so they undergo changes. Most of those mutations are minor, don't mean very much. Sometimes they're enough so that the microbiologists can detect that the origin of the strain was in Europe as opposed to the one that came from China. But there's no functional difference. This change had a functional difference. It allowed this virus to be transmitted even more readily. It became even more contagious. And so that's so distinctive that we label it a different strain. Now, importantly, although it's more contagious, it's not more likely to make you seriously ill. That's a good thing. But think about it. The more contagious it is, the more people it will affect, and in time, it will create more illness simply because it's spread more widely in the population.
Apoorva, let's bring you in here. So it seems like this is maybe the dangerousness of this new variant is not maybe as much as we thought.
It's not more deadly, as Dr. Schaffner just said, but it is more transmissible. And as he mentioned, the more people who get sick and get infected, the more the hospitals will fill up and people will die, not just from COVID, but from other illnesses that they're not getting care for. So even though this variant is not deadly on its own in a particular person, it is definitely a matter of concern.
Bill, did experts expect this to develop? Were they prepared?
We were prepared, but the Brits were prepared even more than we do. They do much more genomic sequencing. They look for these strain variants more intensely than do we. And they picked it up back in September and saw that it was coming. And of course, they began to assess immediately to see whether it had any functional difference and discovered very quickly that it was indeed more contagious.
So, Bill, here's a big question. Will the existing vaccines protect against this variant?
Let me say two things about that. First is we don't know exactly yet. Those laboratory studies are underway. That said, the virologists have looked at this virus and the protection provided by the vaccine and do not think that the vaccine will be impaired, at least not in a major way. That's their anticipation. But the final information is still a few weeks away.
I just want to add something quickly to what Dr. Schaffner said, which is he's absolutely right that we don't know for sure and that so far it looks like the vaccines that we have will be effective. And I just want to offer a little bit more detail about why that's the case. All of the vaccines that we have now are against the spike protein, which is one part of the virus, the outermost part of it that the virus needs to infect our cells. And the mutations of the 23 or so mutations in this new variant, 8 are on the spike protein, which is part of the concern. But I think one very important point is that the vaccines that we take produce just a really, really complex and diverse immune response to, you know, we produce thousands of kinds of antibodies to this protein. So having the virus be mutated in 8 spots on this protein is not as much of a concern as it sounds like at first.
So how are officials handling this in countries where it is a big factor in the spread of the virus?
Well, we saw that some governments decided to block all travel from the UK, and I'm not really sure how effective that is. It's a little bit like closing the barn door after the horse has escaped. I think it's likely that wherever, you know, people are looking, they're finding it. So it's likely that it's actually spread quite far. In the United States, we don't really know how far it's spread. And so there's not really a way to handle it yet. The US sequences very few genomes, unlike the United Kingdom. And the fact that we found it in Colorado is simply because they were looking in Colorado, and they're also looking in New York City and a few other places. But there has not been this sort of concerted effort to look for the virus and how it's mutating here in the United States. And so we don't really have a good plan for how to deal with that. Mm. Scientists across the globe, though, are tracking these mutations and trying to figure out how the virus is changing. As Dr. Schaffner said, it's natural for viruses to collect mutations. And they are looking at how the virus is changing as it travels across the globe, which new variants are coming up, which new variants are becoming more common, and trying to keep an eye on the situation. And if they were to spot, for example, that the virus has changed really dramatically and in a way that might affect vaccines, they would need to start to tweak the vaccines to still be effective.
Bill, it seems to me that testing is at the heart of this. Can the current coronavirus test pick up this new variant, or are they just too different?
No, the current tests will be able to detect this virus. The issue with testing is that we would like to expand its capacity even more so that we can even further define where the virus is and inform our public health responses, both from a national perspective and down at a local perspective in each individual community. So I would hope that going forward, although we have expanded testing quite a bit, we can use testing as an even more assertive public health means to deal with this virus.
But since we are behind in doing the kind of expansive testing that you suggest we need, isn't it likely that this is going to spread faster than we can identify where it spread and how far it spread?
Well, we'd sure like to test more. But the reason this virus is going to spread is that the old strains are spreading. Remember, the conventional, if you will, COVID strain already was a very, very highly contagious virus. The reason it's spreading is that people are not wearing masks. They're not social distancing. We haven't been able to marshal people all across the country to do the same thing, to be conservative now, investing our current inconvenience, I might say, to the benefit of our futures. If we want a much more normal holiday season next year, we're going to have to be very conservative this year and continue to mask, social distancing, hunker down at home for a period of time while our vaccination program begins to gin up.
Now we have the news that it has arrived in the U.S. How much do you see it affecting the trajectory of the virus here?
Yeah, well, if anything, I think it will increase the trajectory of the virus. And of course, we're awaiting yet another surge post-holiday, and that will put, as Apoorva was saying before, a terrific strain on our healthcare system, which is already very, very stretched. So those of us in both public health and healthcare have tightened our belts. It's going to be a tough beginning of the year.
Dr. Bill Schaffner is professor of infectious diseases and preventive medicine at Vanderbilt University. Bill, a pleasure to have you back on the show. Thanks for helping us understand all this.
My pleasure to be with you, and all best wishes for a good year.
Now let's turn to some more questions about the COVID vaccine and how it's being distributed internationally. So far, Apoorva, what countries are getting the vaccine and which countries are at the back of the line?
It's exactly, sadly, as you would expect. The United States and the United Kingdom and some other European countries are at the front of the line and have made deals with the companies that have produced the vaccines to get the vaccine for their citizens. And countries that have fewer resources and much less money, those in Africa and in Asia, are at the back of the line, and it's not clear when exactly they might be able to get the vaccine.
How are vaccine manufacturers prioritizing which countries get the vaccine?
Well, these are for-profit companies, so I'm not sure we could really blame them for their priorities, but they are going by where the money is. They are making deals with countries that are putting in orders for 100 million doses at a time. They are manufacturing doses as quickly as they can, but there is a limited manufacturing capacity overall. And we've also seen, as you know, that it's not even just a question of making the vaccines. Once you make them, you have to get them to all the places they need to go. So they're dealing with all of those logistical hurdles. And so far, it's the richer countries that are winning.
So what would prioritization look like in an ideal world? Could that be achieved?
I think it could, but it requires discipline on the part of some of these richer countries, and it requires coordination across a global scale, which could be done by organizations like the Gates Foundation and the World Health Organization, which are heavily involved and are trying to negotiate a lot of these deals. But ultimately, it's all going to come down to price. You know, these countries that are more resource poor are not going to be able to afford to vaccinate their millions and perhaps hundreds of millions, and in the case of India, more than a billion citizens if the vaccines are not affordable enough. It may be that it will come down to a situation, as happened with antiretroviral therapy for HIV, in which case it wasn't until countries, companies in India and South Africa started to produce the drugs at low enough prices that the drugs could be rolled out to some of the poorer countries.
So a lot of wealthy countries are focusing on vaccinating their own populations. But what issues does that present in terms of beating the pandemic globally? I've heard that some countries aren't going to even get the vaccine until 2024.
Yeah, it's really, I think we've seen already with the way that this virus has spread that we live in a very interconnected world. So the idea that somehow we could all be vaccinated in the United States, but if nobody's vaccinated in Morocco or some other place where Americans like to travel, that we would still be fine is a fallacy. I mean, we've the UK, the finding this new variant shows us that the virus is mutating. It's actually mutating faster than scientists had expected it to. At first, at the beginning of this pandemic, we thought that coronaviruses don't mutate that much, but it's looking like actually they do. And this one in particular has been collecting mutations pretty quickly. And that's because of the sheer number of people who are infected. Every time the virus infects a person, it has chances to mutate. So the more people infected, the more mutations it's going to pick up, the more likely that it's going to pick up mutations that make it deadlier or make it more transmissible, as has happened with this new one. And at some point, it is going to change enough that we'll need new vaccines. Or maybe some particular countries will have a variant of the vaccine that, a variant of the virus that our vaccines don't respond to. So it's in our interest globally to make sure that all of us across the world are vaccinated.
Well, given that, how long will it take for there to be enough supply to meet global demand?
That's an excellent question, and I'm not sure that we know the answer to that. Part of the problem is that vaccine manufacturing can be very tricky. You could have one big batch go wrong, and you might lose hundreds of thousands of doses or even millions of doses. So far, we have already seen, you know, huge problems with how the vaccine is being rolled out, with how carefully all of the steps have to be coordinated. And there's the problem of that last mile of getting it from where it's stored to actually the people who need it. So the idea is that if everything goes well, if everything gets produced on time and rolled out on time, we might all be vaccinated in the United States by the fall, but that's already not the case. So it's extremely hard to predict globally. I will say that there are some companies in India that are looking to manufacture in huge batches. There's one company called BioE that has said it plans to produce 1.2 billion doses. And I think if companies like that step up and start to produce at mass scales and at low enough prices, we might be looking at the next 2 to 3 years in terms of vaccine rollout across the globe. But then again, we might need to start all over with vaccines for a new variant or a new strain, which is when there are enough mutations that it has changed completely.
Do you expect things to change under the Biden administration when it comes to distribution?
Hopefully, yes. They have said that they've asked for the plans for distribution, and Mr. Biden has said that he did not see a very good plan for distribution and rollout, and it looks like he might have been right. So hopefully they have a better plan. But let's not forget that they are inheriting huge numbers of cases and a surge that will take quite a while to slow down. And so for a while, at least, it's going to be an uphill struggle, and we're not going to see the positive effects right away, nor should we expect to.
Apoorva Mondavilli, science reporter at The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us again, Apoorva.
Thank you for having me.
The pandemic has highlighted our nation's worst disparities and inequities in wealth, healthcare, and of course, housing. According to the Aspen Institute, 30 to 40 million Americans could be facing eviction in the coming months. The latest stimulus bill has pushed back the end of the CDC's moratorium on evictions from December 31st to January 31st, staving off the next chapter in this American housing crisis for just a little while longer. When this next eviction wave does crash, Black women in this country will most likely be the hardest hit. According to data from the National Women's Law Center and the ACLU, Black women are twice as likely to be behind on their rent as white renters and have historically faced evictions at twice the rate of white people in at least 17 states. Chabeli Karazana is an economy reporter for the 19th, where she's been covering this eviction disparity. She joins me now. Chabeli, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What factors have led to more Black women in this country historically having higher rates of eviction?
Yeah, so this year, you know, we've seen in many different ways how Black women have been disproportionately affected by this pandemic. And a lot of it are factors that were already in place when all of this started, right? And so, you know, I think you mentioned it a little bit. Before 2020, Black women already faced evictions at really high rates. But they were already, you know, 70% of Black women were already the primary or only breadwinner in their families. So they bear a lot of the economic weight in their families, in their households, and in their communities. And when we have a year with a pandemic recession where women have been affected the most, women of color most of all, that situation becomes very precarious. And so you have a year like 2020 when Black women hit 16.5% unemployment at the worst point, right? And that's the highest it's been in almost 40 years. And that's, you know, that makes them the group with the second highest unemployment. And so you have all of these factors sort of coming together for Black women specifically that makes them more vulnerable to this eviction crisis. And so we've been talking to folks across the country about who are trying to help renters with eviction cases. And they tell us over and over again, the majority of the cases we're looking at are people of color, and the majority of those are typically Black women specifically. And so we already know with some of the data that we have so far this year that the renters that are most likely to be behind on their payment are Black women.
So what are the long-term consequences of eviction, especially for Black women?
Yeah. So, you know, eviction, you don't want an eviction on your record. Having an eviction on your record makes it much harder to find stable, good housing, affordable housing in the future. It's already an incredible impediment to that getting that stability. There's also other complications. You know, children who are evicted face, you know, child welfare issues. They face mental health issues. Their education could be stopped. And so there's a number of factors that play out sort of this ripple effect that comes out when you have an eviction. And so what it does is really it puts you in the cycle, right, where you have an eviction, now it's even harder to find housing, it's even harder to find affordable housing, and so it's a cycle of poverty that becomes very difficult to come out of. And so, unfortunately, what we have seen already historically is that Black women have been finding themselves in that cycle already, and that's the concern now is how much the pandemic is going to heighten that issue.
So how effective has the CDC's moratorium on evictions been? And have Black women, for instance, found real protection through it?
Yeah, so there have been several moratoriums this year. The CDC is only the latest one. Earlier in the year, the CARES Act, the first coronavirus stimulus, put a moratorium in through July 24th. We saw some states and localities also have their own moratoriums. And then the CDC one came into effect on September 4th. And so each one has had sort of different parameters for the kind of protections that it has. Specifically with the CDC moratorium, it's for non-payment of rent. So folks can still be evicted for other issues like noise or having too many people in your apartment, issues that can come up in a pandemic if you're doubling up with family or you've lost your job. You know, there are a number of other situations and other routes that landlords can take to try to evict folks, even with this moratorium in place right now. And you know, recently the CDC clarified a little bit its moratorium, essentially saying, you know, landlords can already file evictions, even though they're not going to get taken to court or processed yet. Those evictions can be filed. And so we've seen some 162,000 or so evictions filed across the country already. It's difficult to say specifically who, but just what we know anecdotally from different areas in the country where folks are handling a large number of eviction cases, many of those are eviction cases dealing with Black women specifically.
So on Monday, the New York legislature approved a bill that puts a ban on all evictions caused by COVID-based hardships until May. Are other states taking similar measures to help their residents?
You know, I haven't heard of other states. I did hear about the New York case, and that seems to be an anomaly. I haven't really heard of other states that are taking this up. And sort of the question really with these moratoriums is, the moratorium is kind of a Band-Aid, right? We're still going to have to deal with what is the primary issue here, which in a month at the end of January is still that we are 10, 11 months of back rent that folks have not paid. And so, you know, that's the thing with the moratorium is it gets at some of the issue because it keeps people in their houses. It keeps them safe in a pandemic. You don't want them, you know, out on the street or in overcrowded shelters. But there are still months and months of back rent that need to come due.
So as we've said, the disproportionate rate of Black women being evicted in this country has only been made worse because of the pandemic. Is there any hope that COVID-19 could inspire state or federal officials to really tackle systemic issues that led to this disparity?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the hope for a lot of what's happened during the pandemic is that we're going to look at these issues a little bit closer. Because like you said, you know, this is a historic issue. The reason that Black women are most affected, you know, if we think about the New Deal, if we think about redlining, if we think about, you know, policies that denied domestic workers and farm workers, which were a lot of them were Black women from labor protections, this is all comes back historically. And so what is perhaps slightly reassuring is we know the Biden administration is really focused in on this problem, wanting to address it. They say day one, we'll see what happens in January. But, you know, Biden has proposed expanding funding for Section 8, the voucher program. He has proposed two tax credits that are targeted specifically at renters. So one would let them write off housing costs that exceed 30% of their income. The other one would let them get an advanceable credit of up to $15,000 to pay for the down payment of a house. And so we know that there is a focus in the incoming administration on this issue. And, you know, he just appointed Representative Marsha Fudge as the head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development of HUD. And she is a Black woman who is specifically focused on civil rights, on trying to address these disparities. That's what we spoke to her recently at the 19th. And she said, you know, short term, I really want to keep people from being evicted from their houses. Long term, you know, I want to run a bottom up approach, right? Where I talk to people who run public housing, people who live in public housing, people who build low income housing. And so her focus gives us some idea of how this following administration could potentially address some of these long running disparities.
Chabeli Karazana is an economy reporter for the 19th. Chabeli, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
I'm Callie Crossley in for Tanzina Vega. 2020 has been bookended by two significant achievements for Black animators. In February, the Best Animated Short Oscar went to writer and co-director Matthew Cherry's Hair Love, about a Black father learning how to style his daughter's hair. And last week, Pixar released Soul, its first movie with a Black lead character and its first with a Black co-director. But the year has also been a tumultuous one for Black animators and voice actors. Over the summer, a number of white voice actors stepped away from their roles as animated characters of color. And overall, Black creatives remain highly underrepresented in the animation field. Joining me now is Bruce W. Smith, creator of the upcoming The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder, one of the co-directors of Hair Love, and he was a supervising animator on The Princess and the Frog. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Ian Jones-Corti, an animator and executive producer who's worked on shows including Adventure Time, Steven Universe, and The Venture Brothers. Thanks for being here, Ian.
Hi, Kelly.
And Angelique Perrin is a voice actor and co-host and producer of Cafe Mocha Radio on WBLS. Great to have you with us, Angelique.
Hey, Kelly.
Bruce, you got your start as an animator in the 80s. Back then, were you working alongside many other Black animators?
Ironically, the first studio I worked with, the door was answered by Phil Mendez. Phil Mendez was an African-American artist who actually had roots at Disney. Was actually a New York artist and had started his own studio. And for me, it was a summer job coming out of CalArts. That was the first face that I actually met as a professional artist in this business was Phil Mendez.
Hmm. Ian, what was your initial experience in animation? And were you often one of the only animators of color in the room?
Yeah, I was. However, you know, similar to Bruce, like one of my first jobs, one of my supervisors was Kimson Albert, who's a Black man, and we worked in New York on Venture Brothers and lots of other things. I am used to being one of the only Black people in the room in L.A. It happens more often.
And Angelique, as a voice actor, have you done many auditions where the producers are explicitly looking for Black performers?
Well, I would say that for the Jedi I played in Star Wars, she had dark skin and is typically, when she's shown in the live action versions, she's typically a woman of color, a Black woman, perhaps African. So, you know, that was expressly what George Lucas wanted, a Black actress for that particular role of Adagalia. But typically, if it doesn't say, then you play the character mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, you created The Proud Family in the early 2000s. What did you want to do on the show that hadn't previously been seen with an animated Black family?
Well, for me, when I did that show, there was nothing in that space that actually, you know, you're talking about, you know, the African-American sitcom, the animated sitcom. Yeah, at that time, you had, you know, The Simpsons and Family Guy and The Critic. You had all these TV shows that were, you know, pretty much animated sitcoms that were, you know, aimed at the mainstream. And I wanted to create The Proud Family to fit in that same lane, an African-American sitcom that was aimed at the mainstream.
So, Ian, now that you've created and produced your own shows, do you have more of a say who gets hired?
On the show I co-executive produced, Steven Universe, and the show I created myself, OKKO, Let's Be Heroes, I was able to have a lot of control over who was hired in terms of artists, but also voice actors. Yeah.
Have you gotten pushback from executives when you try to hire people of color for your shows?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of that, we'll probably talk about this more, but a lot of that comes from the fact that actors of color and women of color especially are underrepresented in the industry. And so the pushback we would often get was, well, why don't you go with this voice, which we've heard before, or we know, or has less risk to go with. I work in TV, so everything moves really fast, and all of the producers above me really want to make sure that there's like no risk going in, so they don't want me to hire people they've never heard of before.
So following that, Angelique, are there specific skills that voice actors need to develop? Because if they don't want to take a risk, I guess they assume you may not have these certain skills.
Look, Kelly, I have done tons of classes out here in Los Angeles. I mean, by trade, I'm a radio personality, but I was a theater major. So when I came to LA, I did tons of specific classes for animation. And I remember getting booked for a pilot. It was a Will Smith cartoon that never took off. I walked out of the booth and the casting director looked at me and she said, "Why have I never heard of you before?" And that's sort of the problem. There's a huge disconnect between the talent out there and the people casting for the talent. They love the people that they know, and for the people that they don't, who have had, you know, little, small, significant roles throughout their career, they don't think to reach out. So, you know, there's a big problem.
Over the summer, several prominent white actors stepped away from their roles voicing characters of color. What was your reaction?
Well, I applauded them, and I had to write an opinion piece to The Hollywood Reporter to respond, because some of those roles I didn't even get to audition for. I've been doing this for 20 years. How do I not get to audition for a role that calls for a black female character, or mixed? I'm sorry. I don't want to, you know, multiracial. Yeah. So I was both horrified that so many were out there, white characters playing white actors playing black characters, but then also horrified that I didn't get the opportunity to play any of those roles because I wasn't offered an audition.
Ian, actors of color are also overlooked when it comes to voicing characters like aliens or mystical creatures that don't have race in animated shows. Do producers need to be more imaginative when it comes to casting those roles?
Yeah, absolutely. On the show I co-executive produced, Steven Universe, the main cast are almost all aliens, and we ended up casting a majority women of color, and it was just because these were the voices that we hadn't heard before, and I really would love people to be a little more open to finding those voices, because, you know, for me, it's less about the idea of matching character skin color to the actor, but actual, like, economic justice. I want women of color and actors of color to get paid and get respect and have prominence within the industry.
Amen.
So Bruce, when you worked on 2009's The Princess and the Frog, which had Disney's first black princess, but more than 10 years later, Pixar has its first black lead character in Soul. Are you disappointed that it's taken so long to see more black animated lead characters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's a whole generation almost passing by before anyone thinks of, hey, you know, let's take this film that we've got right now and sort of recast the lead, you know, and let, you know, an African-American enjoy and participate. I mean, that's just been the whole thing since I've been in this business. It's like we love this business as African-American artists, but we want to participate. Like, we want to be involved in all of the flights of fancy. You know, I've worked on so many projects that did not involve me from an animation standpoint, but I had to put myself in the character, you know, so actually it's helped me as an animator. It's helped, you know, help separate myself and my skill set from the crowd because of the things that I do as an African-American to put in the character. But that still doesn't necessarily reflect the character that's actually on the screen as being a person of color. And that's sort of been an issue with me for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Angelique, when voice actors of color are cast, it's often relatively big name actors who get the part. Are you hoping to see Hollywood move away from reliance on big names in order to give other voice actors like yourself a chance?
I would love that. You know, the jobs that I have auditioned for that were specifically black female characters or male often went to like Regina King, Sanaa Lathan, Nia Long. But the thing that I can bring, I cannot bring what Regina King does. But what I can do is I could also play the grandma.
And I could also play Rollo.
I can do, you know, I can do different things. I don't do what they do, but they don't do what I do. So when you cast Sanaa Lathan, who's a fabulous A-list black actress, you just get that, and you don't get the levels that you're going to get with someone who does this the way I do and who relishes it.
So what do you think animation studios need to do in order to make the animation industry more welcoming to animators of color and voice actors of color? And I'll start with you, Ian.
For me, and, you know, this just goes for everything, it's really just about being aware of what's going on. For instance, when I created my show, OKKO, Let's Be Heroes for Cartoon Network, I was only the second Black creator for the network. And the first Black creator was Andre 3000. So, you know, he got to come in the door a completely different way than I did. I think that studios need to be aware that, you know, talent, people of color, you know, they're rare in this industry, but it doesn't mean we don't have the talent. They need to just be aware and cast their net a little wider. And I really hope that that's going to happen more as we get more people being able to come to prominence, you know, using the internet. And it's hopefully easier to find those people.
So, Bruce, what about you? What do you think?
Ooh. Oh, man. Yeah, I agree with Ian. I mean, I think it's really about opportunity. I think, you know, for us to have the opportunity will help paint and put the industry on course and on par for what we in the foreseeable future. Because, listen, one thing you can't deny in life is that we as a Black people, we drive culture. we just do. So that always when you see our stories being told and when you drop us in movies, it makes those movies that much more interesting, you know, because of the language that we bring, the swag that we bring. Those are the things that are necessary. Those are the things that they look for. So, you know, moving forward, producers, always you should think about that.
Angelique, how do you weigh in?
I weigh in like this. This isn't easy work to be more inclusive. It's going to take a couple of extra steps for this to happen. And it could be something simple as grabbing six of the best little drawers in, you know, whatever neighborhood, bringing them in and mentoring them for a year. It could be something that small, just mentoring aspiring, you know, animators, voice actors, or it could be a larger program where we go, hey, let's invest in the future of this industry. But we know that there's the talent out there, but the talent has to be given the opportunity, and people need to be open to opening that door to allow other faces, other ideas, and other types of creativity in.
Ian, this year you worked on a series of anti-racism shorts for Cartoon Network. Is animation a good medium for addressing the serious issues of the kind we've been talking about?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll say it a million times. Animation is uniquely positioned to be a medium that expresses and teaches empathetic skills and gets characters across. You know, at the end of the day, animation is, you know, it's like a century-old magic trick. We're basically forcing your brain to look at these images, hear these sound effects, and believe that that's a real person and a real character. The reason why animation is so powerful is because that power comes from you, the viewer. You put all those things together in your brain, and you create the characters as well as us giving you the material to do so. Animation is incredibly powerful in that way, and I hope more people pay attention.
Bruce, there has been some criticism that in both The Princess and the Frog and Soul, the Black lead character has spent a lot of the movies outside of their Black skin. What do you make of those critiques?
You know, it's an odd thing. I can't even account it to it being intentional or anything like that. It's just a weird phenomenon that I think, you know, that kind of caught everyone's kind of eye, because I can't explain it. No, any more than that. I think Princess and the Frog, that's just the story. So no matter who was going to be cast in that role. They were going to turn into a frog ultimately. So, and so I think it's simply told within the fiber of the story. Just makes sense to me. And in Soul also, you know, the character did not spend the whole movie, you know, as a soul. I mean, we did see a portion, you know, a good portion of the movie where he comes back. Spoilers. Spoiler alert. But,
yes.
But I don't know. I think that that's an odd phenomenon. It just simply seems to add up for whatever reason. I can't explain, you know, the Spies Like Us, I think, that movie was, where the character turned into a bird. It's just a weird phenomenon. I don't know if producers, just in the back of their mind, there's only so much blackness they can take on the screen at one time. I kind of don't know.
I had to ask the question because, you know, Black Twitter is not having it. The people have added up the minutes of how long the princess was the princess and how long she was a frog. And same thing with Soul now. I mean, you know, they're very unhappy. Just saying.
That's pretty funny.
Okay. Now, what people are happy about, we mentioned that Hair Love won the Best Animated Short Oscar back in February. What did that win mean to you since you were part of that?
Yeah, that was sensational. That was something that we all kind of did not expect, to be honest with you. It's like we were just out to really make a great movie. We thought that, you know, Matthew Cherry's just the genesis of the idea we thought was fantastic. And I think, you know, it just caught the sort of the emotional heartstrings of a lot of artists in the business outside of, you know, just talent around around town. So you saw it got crowdfunded, but it got crowdfunded by some pretty essential people in Hollywood. So I think we knew that it was necessary. You know, when the guys approached me to come on board, I knew it was a necessary project. I was doing something else at the time, and I knew it was necessary, and I knew I wanted to be involved just because of what it stood for.
Well, count me among the millions who wept many times over that little film. So just want to let you know it really struck a chord.
I cry while making it. Yeah. So,
yeah. Okay, there you go. Well, I'm glad to know that. All right, I have a question for all of you, and that is, are there any upcoming animated shows or movies from creators of color that you're excited for? Angelique, I'll start with you. Well, of course, I have to talk about hopefully season two of LaShawn Thomas's Cannon Busters. I love LaShawn. I describe him as this young brother from Queens who said, I want to make my own cartoon. He went to Korea, learned the inner workings of how animation, the art of animation is done, and came back. I met him in Korea, and I used to just send him voice work for his characters. He did a Kickstarter campaign, made some money for a pilot, and Cannon Busters wound up on Netflix after years of hard work. So I'm looking forward to a second season of that, and as well as whatever he comes up with, because I think it's so important we continue to support the Black animation that's out there. You know, we have to watch the shows. We can't just complain that, you know, there's not enough of it. When it shows up, we have to support it. So that's, you know, part two of that discussion. I had no idea, Ian, I had no idea that Steven Universe was yours.
Wow.
I did get to audition for that, though. So, you know, I'm in the business. I had no idea. So press, you know, get out there, get in front of people and let them know.
Well, there's one way. Ian, I want to ask you the same question. Are there any upcoming animated shows or movies from creators of color that you're excited for?
I also think LaShawn Thomas is amazing. A show I'm looking forward to actually was Everett Downing, who worked on Hair Love, is going to be doing a Netflix series called My Dad the Bounty Hunter, which looks really awesome. And then another show that I'll always give props to is a show on Cartoon Network, Craig of the Creek. It has white creators, but a large part of the writing and storyboarding staff are Black people and people of color. And I'm really looking forward to more of those shows. It's a great show just about kids being kids. And the main character is, you know, just like the kind of black kid who I was when I was a kid. And it's just really exciting to see that.
What kind of kid were you?
Oh, I was just similarly the kind of kid who was always trying to, you know, create things, draw stuff, have like, you know, little adventures with my friends. I was like constantly trying to rope my friends into like making movies with me and stuff like that. So, it's fun to see like that type of character on TV for other kids to have.
And finally, Bruce, to you, are there any upcoming animated shows or movies from creators of color that you're excited for?
Oh, man, I agree with you with the Everett Downing piece. Because, yeah, Ev is my dude, and I know he was really excited to get that shot at Netflix. Now you see a lot of opportunity being sort of spread throughout. I know a lot of my friends have their head down in projects that I can't mention right now.
No, you can mention it. We'd be happy to have the scoop.
But I think I can see the next, you know, easily, you know, I can see the next 10 years as really the industry mining, you know, black talent for projects that are black that feel authentic. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, Craig of the Creek, you know, once upon a time, you know, if the Proud Family and Craig of the Creek were in the same, were of the same era, one would cancel out the other. You know what Absolutely. I mean? But now we're in a space where we hope that we get, you know, to see many sides of blackness, you know, from the shows that are grounded to the shows that sort of are kind of lift off the ground and are full of whimsy and being, you know, inclusive in areas that we just weren't allowed to play in for such a long time. So that's what I look forward to. I mean, this kind of reminds me of a little bit of the blaxploitation era, you know, where you, you know, now Hollywood is really mining the, you know, black talent. And we just hope that window stays open much longer than, you know, 7-8 years.
Bruce W. Smith is the creator of the upcoming The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder. Ian Jones-Corti is the creator of OKKO, Let's Be Heroes. And Angelique Perrin is a voice actor and co-host and producer of Cafe Mocha Radio on WBLS. Thank you all for speaking with me.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having us.
That's all we have for you guys today. We appreciate your listening. Call us if you want to hear about something in particular, or just call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet to me at Callie Crossley. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Callie Crossley, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.